you then go from one computer affected or that they are able to control to maybe five, right? And then from those five computer systems to maybe 5 or 10 more computers per system. So as you kind of spider out, you know, one of the environments that was impacted now starts impacting, you know, thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of kind of downstream individuals.
You know, having to completely rebuild from scratch one of those production environments, which for those who don't do that on a daily basis, that would have been potentially like months of work.
Having a robust security system in place and an expert with over 15 years of cybersecurity experience on team, you'd think you'd done enough to be safe. Yet as one software service company would soon learn, for the sophisticated criminal, there's no such thing as safe enough. This is the Cyber Crime Lab, a podcast about true cybercrime stories, the impact on victims, and what businesses can do to protect themselves and their customers. And if you think you're not at risk, that is exactly where attackers want you to be.
In my experience, it only takes hearing what these attacks are like a few times to realize you need to prepare yourself for what could be a business-ending experience.
That's Andy Anderson, the founder and CEO of DataStream Insurance. For over a decade, Andy has been working with victims of cybercrime. He's seen firsthand the human impact of a cyber attack. Now, he's on a mission to shed light on the threats we all face from a world we can't see. Today, Andy has invited Luke Emrich, the Director of Incident Response at Tetra Defense, to the Cyber Crime Lab. However, Luke is not the victim of today's case, but rather the lead investigator.
So, maybe for those who don't know your background, if you could just give a little bit of what your role is and kind of your history of dealing with cyber incidents.
I'm currently a case lead. So when an incident comes in, I'm one of the first people that the client will speak to, and we'll have a conversation about the event that's occurring. We'll work through a game plan and strategy as to how do we investigate the event? How do we recover? How do we get the business back up and running? In the past, I've kind of played a lot of different roles kind of in this space, everything from forensic analyst, you know, kind of all the way up to leading and building a practice and kind of doing the case lead role.
Luke, thanks so much for joining us on the Cybercrime Lab podcast. I was really looking forward to this conversation because I know you've been doing this for a long time, helping folks kind of live through these incidents. So with this particular case that we're going to focus on today, we're lucky enough to actually get some time with the actual victim who had lived through this. He wasn't able to actually join us because of some of the confidentiality issues, but maybe we should just give him a name, right? Like, let's just call him Joe.
To understand how aggressive this attack was, you first need to know a few things about Joe. He's not new to cybercrime. At the time of the attack, Joe had over a decade of experience protecting companies from cyber attacks. Prior to being a security engineer, Joe served in the military. He had combat training and understood better than most how to get a job done under the highest level of pressure. Which begs the question, what kind of attack could unsettle a security professional with that amount of experience?
The client actually in this case had a fairly robust security program and was able to kind of quickly assess the impact of the event.
When did the case kick off? When did you first hear of it and what was going on?
Yeah, so it actually, believe it or not, it was a Saturday night.
Isn't it always, right? Does this ever happen on a Tuesday morning?
No.
The attack started Saturday night for Luke, but it began several hours earlier for Joe. He was working for a medium-sized SaaS company in the healthcare space, helping to safeguard their corporate office and several data centers in different parts of the country. We should mention something else about Joe. He took copious notes. From the notes of Joe, the security engineer. Saturday, 5 p.m. I received several messages from the team. Something was wrong with the server. Shutdown alerts coming in, one after the other. I didn't want to believe it was real. It's like everything was moving in slow motion. The antivirus was the first to go.
And it became pretty clear very early on that there were three separate and what they thought were completely distinct networks, not even really subnets, different domains that were all impacted. And it seemed like it had happened kind of very quickly.
Separate domains means that they were literally like separate websites and whole networks, right? And normally you wouldn't see an issue spill from one to the next.
You could even consider these as like three different houses in a neighborhood. How did the burglar get in all of these houses?
From the notes of Joe, the security engineer. Sunday, 4 a.m. The last 7 hours were a blur, constantly on the phone, sick feeling in my stomach. We had essentially lost all visibility across multiple environments. We'd practiced what to do in an attack, but this was real. It was all we could do to shut everything down. It wasn't until Luke and his team joined in that I was finally able to get a little sleep. In the world of cybercrime, one learns to expect the unexpected. However, this criminal managed to pull off an attack beyond the unexpected and entered into the realm of the unreal. An incident Joe now refers to as the scariest experience of his life. Something seemingly impossible to achieve. Unless the attacker knows something, you don't.
So, starts to hit all these environments, and then Sunday morning, you wake up and you're starting to kind of dig in on it. What happens?
Yeah, so a lot of times in these investigations, you know, you have to kind of start at, you know, some of the high value systems or systems that we believe, you know, the threat actor may have really used as part of their attack. And the threat actor in this case kind of used a slightly different tactic than we see very often. They used one system that they would then push out a tool called Cobalt Strike, so kind of a backdoor to some subset of systems past that point.
Cobalt Strike is a tool often used by the U.S. government and large businesses to emulate the tactics and techniques of a threat actor. In cybersecurity war games, the Red Hat hackers will use Cobalt Strike to deploy a payload that creates a connection to their team server. But for Luke and Joe, this was not a game. This criminal had stolen and repurposed Cobalt Strike to deploy ransomware. And as they would soon learn, this wasn't the only tool the threat actor had repurposed.
So we then go from one computer affected or that they are able to control to maybe five, right? And then from those five computer systems, they pushed Cobalt Strike, the same tool, out to maybe 5 or 10 more computers per system. So you can see how this would exponentially grow pretty quickly.
Right out of the box, it's sort of like you were involved in like a train wreck and kind of like trying to pick up from that. Is that pretty common where you just like, you know, you feel like you've been just like hit by a Mack truck when you're one of these IT folks at a organization?
Yes, but it's different levels of car crash, you know, in that scenario. Joe in his company did a lot of planning and preparation for this type of thing. And it's really unfortunate that planning and preparation didn't prevent or didn't catch this early enough to stop it before it escalated. But that being said, yes, it was chaos in the kind of early hours of the investigation, that the first kind of day two, but all of that planning and preparation actually worked out really amazing, because the incident response team that I was working on at the time and his team pretty quickly started working lockstep with each other, where we were sharing information. We were really working hand in hand, not only in the response, but also even the investigation. So one of the challenges that we ran into, and I described this, is the threat actor starts clearing these logs, which makes it very difficult for us to understand where the previous step was. Where was the threat actor before they infected and compromised this system? And one of the pieces of preparation that the organization did is they set it up a backup program that was extremely granular. They were backing up their systems every single hour, most every system in their environment. So as we triage a system to figure out when was it compromised, where was the previous step coming from, we were able to share that with the client team, and basically their team and our team were going through a variety of different workstations, servers in the environment, and almost picking one spot and saying, when was the system impacted?
Why is it so important to go through kind of this deep forensic dive and understand what was the first thing touched? What are the potential alternatives to kind of knowing that, and what are the different pathways that might happen?
When you go through a cyber attack, a ransomware attack specifically, I think a lot of people think that it's just malware. Like somebody's clicked on a link and it's downloaded the malware in the environment, and that's how our systems got infected and encrypted. And the reality is that may have been ransomware circa 2016, 2017, but that's not ransomware today. Ransomware today is there's a threat actor or an adversary that has gained access to your network. They've done a lot of reconnaissance. They've learned where all your systems are. They've probably learned what your username and passwords are in your environment. If you don't figure out how they got in, you can go through all the steps to get your business back up and running if you've got backups per se, but allow the threat actor to come right back and come back in and do it all over again. Maybe it's not even that same threat actor group. We see many of the threat actor groups, the different ransomware groups, using the same tactics and techniques to get in, making sure that you understand the full timeline of the attack and how the threat actor got in, and then coming up with a game plan and strategy to not only clean up, but to take remedial actions to make sure it doesn't happen again is incredibly important.
If I'm remembering correctly, Joe was telling us how he was like, you know, basically like it was a call between, you know, having to completely rebuild from scratch one of those production environments, which for those who don't do that on a daily basis, that would have been potentially like months of work versus, you know, if you can figure out when this started and you can restore from a backup, you're almost back up to normal.
There's a lot of variables that come into play that a lot of organizations probably never thought about when scaling their equipment and what are they buying. What's the timeline to get it back up and running? It's not a day. We're not talking days. We're talking weeks and in some case months.
I mean, it sounds like this organization had been maintaining some legacy stuff for business reasons, right? The whole security team had essentially identified, hey, this is a problem, right?
The primary part of our investigation initially was focused on the corporate domain, because that's where the real important and sensitive data was. But to your point, there was a separate domain that had some of these kind of legacy protocols that were in it, and they purposely separated it into a different domain and kind of a different computing environment to separate it from some of the other assets that were important to the business. Part of the steps that the threat actor started taking more so later on is that they started clearing the security and system and many of the event logs on the computer system.
Basically like sweeping up their tracks as they went. And were they doing that? Like, were you seeing this like as you're investigating, they're like changing up their tactics, or was this something that they just were kind of getting more as they got more control over the systems, they could do that better?
It almost seems like as we went further back, that tactic kind of started dissolving. So the further back or the earlier in the timeframe that we got, we saw less and less event log clearing. It seemed like it was a rush to figure out what was up, you know, in the environment. As soon as a threat actor gains access to a network, they don't immediately know where everything is. It's kind of like the idea of if I went into the front door of a stranger's house, like I don't know the floor plan of the house. I don't know where, you know, the safe is and where the valuables might be. The threat actor kind of needs to do the same thing and figure that out in the network, and also kind of needs to figure out that floor plan in some ways. As we're working through this process of like all hands on deck reviewing, you know, these couple indicators of compromise that we're looking for, there was kind of like an aha or eureka moment where I don't know why it didn't dawn on somebody earlier, but I'm like, hey, you know, do we have any antivirus detections that we need to focus in on? One of the security engineers for the organization said, I don't know, hold on, let me go take a look. So quickly come back and they say, well, there was this detection for Bloodhound. And we didn't really know what it was, so we didn't really think about this. And I knew exactly what Bloodhound was.
So, what is Bloodhound? During an interview for another episode, Andy ended up talking to someone who can answer that question better than most.
For me, I tend to be more of the background person.
Meet Jason Frank, formerly the primary developer and instructor for the Adaptive Penetration Testing training course provided at the Black Hat Security Conference.
I started off as a pen tester, got hooked up with a gentleman by the name of Raphael Mudge who wrote this software called Cobalt Strike.
Now, Jason is the COO at Spectre Ops, the team that developed Bloodhound.
A lot of our team was offensive focused for a long time. And the Bloodhound open source project was released at DEF CON in 2016. And the use case was very offensive focused. You land a fish, you get into an organization. Now, where do you go? And Bloodhound would solve that attack path for you. But obviously, an adversary wants to know the same thing.
How do you think about when you're one of the people who's building those tools, knowing that it's going to be used on both sides? How do you think about that?
One of the core tenets that we have within our company, one of our values, is empowerment through transparency. So years ago, you would trade on knowledge, right? Oh, what was this attacker doing? What was this the mystical magic sauce that they were doing? And our goal with the company is to demystify attacker tradecraft and put it out there so everybody understands what's going on.
As we've stated before, cybercrime thrives in the shadow of ignorance and fear. Jason and his team know how threat actors behave and work to put those tools in everyone's hands. One might use a hammer to break a window, but any craftsman knows its best use is for building. In this case, Bloodhound, like Cobalt Strike, was a tool repurposed for criminals to attack Joe's company. However, that discovery was the final puzzle piece Luke and his team needed.
And I asked them, where was this detection? And they said, it's on actually on our antivirus server. It's our centrally managed antivirus server. We were scratching our head why this went off there, but we didn't really know. And I described the capabilities of the tool and what it was used for. And they were like, oh my God. There were local administrative credentials that were being used. I think this was in the kind of legacy environment. And those credentials should have been changed when a new computer system was provisioned. However, on that antivirus server that bridged the different domains, the different kind of environments, it was not changed. So the threat actor was able to find that password in that legacy kind of environment, and they were able to try it against that antivirus server. And that allowed them kind of the jumping point to go from one domain to the other. And that was a huge point for us. And that's what I was talking about earlier. Once we stepped back into that legacy environment, it was much easier to perform that investigation because this was prior to the threat actor clearing logs. Their tactics were in steps that they took were very much the same, but they weren't clearing the logs every step of the way.
This went on for days, right? And Joe was telling us about how, gosh, like, you know, that first night he barely sleeps, but then it's going on. And his notes were incredible because I remember asking him, like, gosh, why do you have such good notes? He's like, oh, well, you know, the entire company staff basically was told to, you know, we're shut. We're like, we're, you know, we can't do anything. So it was just the security and engineering team and basically like the C-suite, right? Like of the company, right? Couple hundred person company. So, you know, all sort of in a war room and he was having to report on what was going, you know, I think every 3 hours or something crazy like that.
We had that initial call on a Saturday night, as I mentioned. We, as a team, collectively narrowed in on what we believed was root point of compromise on Friday. So the following Friday, I guess 6 days later, and it was about 7 p.m. at that time. They were working nonstop around the clock, and we had a couple of different rounds of people working on our end. Joe and I decided it's time to shut it down for the night. Let's all go get some rest. Let's come back with, you know, some fresh eyes. But then we were able to go back to the business probably around noon, 1 o'clock on that Saturday, and tell them we knew when root point of compromise was. Not only how the threat actor got in, But when they got in, we felt confident that we could start the process of falling back to those backups to restore and really restore business operations.
It sounds like this organization was prepared, right? That's what's so like bananas, right? Like they, you know, they had a good team. They'd been thinking about this sort of stuff, right? And had they not, you probably could have been even worse, right? Because they were down a week plus, but could have been potentially months. What would you recommend, like seeing as much as you do what this is like?
I think it starts with having a robust security program and developing a incident response plan that kind of calls out how to act, when to act. I think another important piece is vulnerability management and patching. I think another thing that organizations can do is having ongoing security monitoring of their systems, whether it's using a security operations center that's watching the logs in your environment, or an EDR product that's watching your systems looking for anomalous activity. It's not only watching for that activity, it's knowing when to react and when to, you know, start implementing containment steps so that the event doesn't escalate.
Yeah, no, I think that's huge and really great advice. Luke, this is really fun. Thank you for coming on, telling us what this is like. I'm blown away by how calm you are and probably serves you well, right? You deal with this on a daily basis.
Andy, thank you for the opportunity. This has been awesome.
Yeah, no, appreciate it.
From the notes of Joe, the security engineer. Monday, 8 a.m. We started recovery. Bastards wanted $800,000 in Bitcoin. Thanks to the hard work and sleepless nights everyone put in, we found a root point of compromise and didn't pay them a dime. All that's left is a long list of clients to call, assuring everyone that this won't happen again. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Cybercrime Lab, brought to you by Datastream Insurance. When the worst happens, you're going to want the best financial, legal, and technical support to get you back up and running again. With cyber insurance from Datastream, we find the most comprehensive insurance coverage on the market alongside critical post-incident customer support. Go to datastreaminsurance.com today and see how we can help you secure your business data. That's datastreaminsurance.com. If you enjoyed today's episode, be sure to subscribe and give us a 5-star review. You'll find show notes and any resources mentioned at cybercrimelabpodcast.com. We hope you'll join us next episode. Until then, stay safe. More importantly, stay ready.